Hi, and welcome to A Time for Change. I'm Marquise Francis here with Alexis Christophorus and Anjali Kimlani. We are an hour away from President Biden addressing the nation about the COVID-19 crisis as cases continue to surge to record numbers because of the Omicron variant. He's expected to give updates on vaccination numbers, treatments, and personnel being dispatched to help fight COVID in the field.
And according to the latest government figures, the daily average of infections in the U.S. is now nearing 500,000, just as all of us were hoping for some relief in this new year. And companies were, of course, hoping to get back to business once and for all.
And here to talk about where we stand and how should we be thinking about this new year is Dr. Oney Blackstock, primary care physician and Health Justice founder and executive director. Dr. Blackstock, pleasure to have you on and unfortunately to once again be talking about yet another year starting off at home. I want to talk about, while we start off with this year and we still see a significant unvaccinated population as we're battling yet another spike in cases, I wonder, some experts have said that we may have opened parts of the country too early. Do you think that's true? And how should employers really be thinking about this new year?
Thanks so much, Anjali, for having me on. And these are incredibly important questions. I think we're seeing, unabated, unfettered transmission or spread of this Omicron virus, which has merged with this other Delta surge throughout the country. It seems like no area is really immune. And there are, I think, many of us in the public health world who feel like there need to be a more robust plan put ahead. You mentioned President Biden is going to be speaking about his plan to attack Omicron. And we really need to see more ambitious, more robust measures taken. I think the plan that he announced several weeks ago with the, sending out 500 million rapid tests, was a decent first step, but we really need to be providing a lot more guidance to states and local jurisdictions around masking, around testing, around standards for ventilation and air filtration, as well as what workplace safeguards can be implemented so that people can return safely to work.
And jumping in here, Dr. Blackstock, there's so many parents, local governments wanting children and young people to get back to work. There's a chorus of people saying it's not the right time, including yourself, I see on Twitter. Why do you say not yet?
Right. So I think, we know that schools in general have been relatively safe places. There have been very low levels of transmission in general within schools. But the issue is that we have, as I mentioned, very high levels of community transmission that are happening. And we started to see towards the end of last year a number of school closures, classroom outbreaks, et cetera. So I think what we need to do is to implement the safeguards. We need to get things under control. We need to make sure that everyone has access to high-grade masks, that we don't have these incredibly long lines for testing. Many people are testing and we don't actually get the results because it's at-home testing, so we don't have a full picture of what's going on. We need to make sure that the funding that was provided to states and localities for ventilation and improving air filtration, that happens. And also seeing things like, paid sick leave so that, workers can stay home if they're sick. All of these things are important in order for children, for people to be able to send their children safely to school. And we saw that, yesterday was the first day back for many schools throughout the country, but we did see a number of school districts, particularly in the Northeast and upper Midwest, decide to either postpone opening or to pivot to remote or to do both, at least for a few days up until a few weeks, in order to get things under better control.
Dr. Blackstock, I want to talk about, I know you mentioned President Joe Biden's plans and the way that the federal government is working, but he did recently say that the way out of this pandemic is essentially going to be at the state level. And I know there have been some health experts that have said even further down to the local level versus the federal level. I just want to hear your thoughts on that.
Well, I think what we have seen and what the reality often is that state policies are often influenced by what the federal policy is. And so, for instance, we don't currently have federal policy guidance to states and local jurisdictions around, you know, at what level of transmission should, for instance, indoor public spaces require masking, for instance. There's very little guidance out there for states. And so what would be really helpful is for, you know, agencies such as the CDC to be much clearer and definitive and use data, sort of data-driven policies to guide when masking policies should be implemented, you know, when we should have mass testing, et cetera. So we do need to have the federal government, you know, modeling and providing that guidance and using its influence to get states and local jurisdictions to implement mitigation measures that we know have worked in the past and that we need now as we face this Omicron surge.
Just a quick follow-up on that too. This seems to be a little bit like what we dealt with in the previous administration. And I know there had been some comparisons after the president made these comments to President Trump. Do you think those are fair?
Just to clarify, in terms of what we've sort of seen, some of these similar
relying
issues
on the state. Correct. Yes.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. No, I think we're seeing a lot of similarities, unfortunately, in terms of how this response is being handled by the federal government. But I think because Biden is maybe more beloved than Trump, we're seeing maybe a little less criticism about the response. But I think we need to see the federal government and states working in tandem to address these issues. And I think the issue around whether it's the federal government's responsibility or state government's responsibility sort of came up when there was a discussion with Biden and the governors around this sort of rapid testing initiative that he was starting. And I think one of the governors, I believe from Arkansas, was concerned about sort of supply of rapid testing for his state because the federal government was, you know, putting in these large orders. So I just think we need to make sure that obviously there's ample supply for all of these initiatives, whether they be at the federal level or the state level, but that they be in tandem and aligned and really focusing on the safety of communities.
And Florida's Surgeon General Joseph Lodapo said Monday, the state is working to unwind COVID testing psychology in a state with a record number of cases. And as a devout Oney Blackstock follower, I know you were disappointed, not only because this was a classmate of yours, but this is also not necessarily backed by science. So with so much of the medical advice being politicized, I'm curious, where is the common ground to getting to a better place as a country?
I mean, we really need to focus on the science and on equity. And so it was a very strange statement to be talking about this sort of testing psychology and about this focus of the federal government on testing when on the podium right in front of Dr. Lodapo was Early Treatment Saves Lives, referring to monoclonal antibody treatment, which we know in order really for people to take advantage of these treatments, they need to have access to testing. So we know that testing is central to being able to ensure that people are able to isolate and don't spread COVID to other individuals and also to get treatment in a timely fashion. So none of it is really making a lot of sense. And we really need to make sure that the policies that we are developing, whether they be at the state or federal level, are really driven by data, are driven by the science, and are also keeping in mind the importance of centering equity in our pandemic response.
Mm-hmm. And as a quick follow, we talked about obviously governments and local jurisdictions not necessarily following a lot of that medical advice, but maybe they may not be listening on Twitter, but they may be watching Yahoo Finance right now. So what would you say to these local and government officials? What's your immediate advice for weathering this current Omicron crisis of sorts?
Right. Yeah. So I actually used to be an assistant commissioner at the New York City Health Department, and I know that many of these health departments are staffed with brilliant, very experienced public health practitioners, people who've devoted their careers to keeping communities and cities and states safe. And so I think when we see guidance coming out, you know, for instance, around the isolation guidance that came out recently where the isolation period was shortened, what we're seeing is other public health departments, local health departments, for instance, deciding we're actually not going to follow this guidance. We are going to use the science, and the data that we have. And we feel that the data supports, you know, keeping the isolation period at 10 days versus a certain 5 days. So I would really appeal to my colleagues at other public health departments, you know, to continue to, you know, use the data and science they have, use, you know, also their intuition if something doesn't sound right, and just making sure that we are creating policies, again, that are backed by data and science. Because the issue is when these guidelines come out that aren't backed by science and data, it undermines like any trust that exists. And we know that the past federal administration and the current response have really eroded a great deal of trust that citizens have had in our government.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. Really quickly before we let you go, Dr. Blackstock, yes or no? We've got some people in the finance world already thinking about COVID as endemic, possibly by the end of this year. Do you agree with that? Yes or no?
Right. So endemic would really mean there's like a constant presence of the virus, you know, at a low level, and there may be periodic outbreaks or possibly, you know, an annual increase during winter time. Mm-hmm. I don't think, given the surges that we're still seeing and the challenges of keeping transmission at a low level, I think that that's a long ways away. But also we have to think about how the word endemic is defined. And it's really about, you know, how much sort of death and hospitalizations as a society we're willing to tolerate. And so I do hope that we choose a definition of endemicity that really you know, is ensuring that we are protecting lives and the quality of life of all Americans.
Fair enough. All right, Dr. Oney Blackstock, Health Justice Executive Director and Founder, thank you so much for joining us today. Up next, as COVID continues to reshape how and where we work, we will be talking to the author of a new book, The Workplace You Need to Know. That's still ahead.
I've been running my own gym for a little over 3 years now.
What's up, brother?
There is no better feeling than when you change someone's life for the better. I started investing to put money back into my business. I use Yahoo Finance to research and stay on top of my game. I invest in my business for my family's future.
I'm just all about, you know, living life to the fullest. Wherever I play, I go big. In the stadium or Yahoo Fantasy.
Draft day, baby.
You're going down this year, my friend.
First pick right here.
Gutless.
Did you even want to win this year?
With the third pick, Team Juju selects.
Bro. You're a fourth round pick at best.
Man, your season's over. You're done.
Yeah, keep talking.
What in the Matrix hell?
Welcome to Space Jam.
Get ready.
When I beat you, all of the tunes will be deleted, so.
For the summer's biggest event.
What up? It's Porky Pig. They call me King Double. Your squad is all jokes. This battle's now over. That's all, folks. Next. Just like I drew it up.
Space Jam.
Rent or own the latest movies with Verizon Fios On Demand.
Welcome to Influencers. I'm Andy Serwer.
Individuals have to become financially literate.
Maybe there is a path forward.
This is an incredible moment in American history.
We have a time where people are actually talking about things they never talked about before.
Look at the trajectory of humankind.
You can have honesty and transparency as a value.
The more you get done, the more opportunity you're going to be given.
Stick around long enough, you'll see everything in markets.
Welcome back to A Time for Change. A new job number is out today, show a record 4.5 million people quit their jobs in November, which begs the question, where are they all going and how can companies get them to stay? Here to discuss is Sanjay Rishi, JAL Work Dynamics America's Chief Executive Officer, also the author of the book, The Workplace You Need to Know. Sanjay, thanks so much for being with us. I want to start with those job numbers that we got today, because At the same time, we've got these record 4.5 million Americans quitting their jobs. Employers posted nearly 11 million job openings in the same month. So when you look at those two stats together, what does that tell you about the state of the job market right now and how people are thinking about work?
Great to be here, Alexis. Glad to talk to you. Telling statistics, and this is all about the world around us changing, and the talent wars have never been like this before. So that's the challenge for organizations, is how do you attract talent? How do you retain talent? And the workplace plays a very important role in helping organizations do that. And that's what we explored in our book.
Anjali here. I wonder, we talk about a lot about flex hours, especially as, you know, the pandemic has forced employers to deal with this. But it seems like there isn't necessarily a broad consensus on that. Different people want different things. How do we sort of make all that work for a post-pandemic world?
Yeah, great question, Anjali. And actually, you know, as we looked at this, there's clearly so much uncertainty around even the definition of hybrid or flexible. So on a regular basis, we've been conducting surveys with thousands of people across the globe, across our client set, across large organizations and employees. And what's evident now is over the months, so just to give you some comparisons and numbers from a year ago, let's say a little bit, let's say April of last year to now, we're starting to see people wanting to get back to work. So this whole idea of the sense of belonging, people are really missing that energy they get from the office. From a productivity standpoint, the drop is fairly significant on how people assess their own productivity, down from 48% to 37% in the latest survey that that we did. So there's this desire to get back to work in a workplace, but not 100%. So the idea of hybrid, flexible around, let's say, 2 days, 3 days a week, and people wanting to get back just to create that sense of belonging because they're starting to miss that. And there's so much fatigue from staying at home. Of course, the social, the demographic challenges, et cetera, are playing into this.
You know, Sanjay, one of the other challenges that businesses were dealing with even pre-COVID are now they've got multiple generations working within the same company. You've got baby boomers, Gen Z, Gen X, Generation Alpha, now all working together. And that can be a challenge for a company's culture. What's the best way that companies can try to sort of find a balance, if you will, between those cross generations?
Yeah, we talk about this in the book, Lexis. The caution here is not to sort of broad brush across a generation, because there are so many other factors that play into it. It isn't just the generation, whether it's a Gen Z, Gen Y, but also, people in terms of, single mothers or parents or, certain parts of the geography of the world that are limited with what they can do. So we talk about in the book, places like certain cities in Asia, where they don't have the luxury of having the square footage and the luxury of working from home. There are multiple sort of job earners, if you will, that work from the same home, sometimes four, sometimes five people in limited square footage. So the caution there is it's more than just the demographic, but culture really is about the very purpose of the workplace has changed. This isn't someplace that we went to, because we talked about for the longest time about going to work. You no longer go to work. And the purpose of the workplace has to be a social hub. This idea of apprenticeship and training and creating a sense of belonging and a culture. Talent is so portable. Going back to your earlier statistics, today, if I'm working from home every day, my sense of belonging to my employer is relatively limited, especially to my work group. Is very limited as opposed to going and having that social interaction and a sense of belonging. So all of this is the imperative for organizations to adopt and adapt their workplaces.
And in fact, you talk about the four C's of value in your book: culture, collaboration, creativity, and community. That's a lot for a company to take on. Who is doing it right now when you look out onto the corporate landscape? Can you give us a concrete example of a company that seems to be succeeding in that area?
Yeah, we actually have, 20-25 vignettes and extended stories about organizations, but I'll pick on a couple of them. We opened the book with Microsoft as an example, and how Microsoft is going about creating a culture addressing the needs of hybrid and flexible workplace, and at the same time, making sure that creativity that they require of their workforce is engendered in the workplace. They're actually redesigning and have redesigned their workplaces. There's so much emphasis on environment and sustainability, and aligning organizational values, Alexis, to individual values is increasingly important today. And I think that's absolutely critical. Microsoft is doing this in a very big way. The one example we talk about is in Atlanta, where they've set aside and they're investing in the entire community and bringing together, really manifesting this idea of a responsible workplace in terms of uplifting the entire community, making sure inclusion and this idea of an inclusive workplace comes to life. There's other examples in the book that we talk about in terms of this culture and how do you take the workplace outside the physical office and into the homes of people. Capital One Bank is another very good example that we talk about. But that's just a couple of examples, Alexis.
Sanjay, really quickly, because we're almost out of time, but in 30 seconds, you talked about the international sort of perspective, and it seems like we do think about this with a very U.S. lens on it. Would you say that flex hours is largely a U.S. sort of newness, or is it globally that we've been dealing with this new change in office?
No, this is a change that stays with us, and it stays across the globe, Anjali. People want that level of flexibility, even with the limited square footage. In my earlier example, they do want the flexibility to decide when to come to work. Flexibility is here to stay, but the idea that work can be remote is something that's been proven wrong in terms of statistics around productivity, around creativity, around innovation, around the sense of belonging, and the culture that's pervasive across people that come to work and also work from home in those flexible. So this is something that we will live with. This is an inflection point. It has changed, and it's changed for good.
All right. Sanjay Rishi, JLL Work Dynamics America's CEO. And also, again, the book is called The Workplace You Need Now. Thanks so much for being with us.